You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When you're deciding which candidates you want to support in an election, how much of your choice depends on their policies and their positions on the issues that are important to you? In his book, Invisible Influences, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior, Jonah Berger, professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, argues that whether we realize it or not, a lot of our behavior and choices are influenced by the beliefs and opinions of the people around us, our friends, family, and coworkers. I spoke with him back in June, and we are rebroadcasting that conversation for you now. Your background is in marketing, and in your previous book, Contagious, you wrote about how ideas and businesses catch on, and now you're talking about behavior. Would you say that behaviors like businesses are contagious?
Certainly. Whether we're talking about smoking behavior or exercise, behaviors are just as contagious as products and services can be.
What in particular did you observe that sparked your interest in this topic?
Yeah, so I've been a scientist for a few years now and was talking to a friend of mine in Washington, D.C., who's a lawyer in D.C., and I mentioned that I was interested in social influence and how it shapes behavior. And he noted, God, you know, I see it all the time. D.C. lawyers, they make it big, they become partner, and they go out and buy a BMW. Mm-hmm. They're all conformists. And I said, That's interesting, but you know, aren't you a DC lawyer and don't you actually drive a BMW? And he said, oh no, but not me. You know, I drive a blue BMW. They all drive gray ones. And what I love about that story is two things. One, sometimes we do see influence. We see it, but we see it in others. We look around, we see other people dressing the same, driving the same car, their kids look the same, but not us. There's no way that influence affects our behavior. We pick things because we like it, but often we don't realize that influence is actually occurring.
And scientists are looking into this. Let's talk about some experiments. What's the lion experiment that was conducted by Solomon Asch?
It's a great old study that looked at perception. So imagine you're in a room and you're asked to judge the length of lines. They throw you three lines, a short line, a middle-length line, and a long one. And they show you a different line and say, which of the three lines is the same as this fourth line? Really easy to tell. And the short one looks like the short one, middle, and so on. But they don't just make it that simple. They actually have a number of other people in the room that you think are other subjects in the experiment that go before you. And so imagine you're sitting there. There are three lines. You think the answer is A. And they ask the first person for their answer. That person says B. And the next person comes up and they go, oh, well, B. And the next person goes B. And then it comes up to you. And you're sitting there going, well, God, it looks like A, but all these people have said B. What should I do? And what they find is even in situations like that where the answer's clear, we tend to go along with the group.
So we submit to peer pressure.
It's not just peer pressure. So I think when we say peer pressure, we really think of someone trying to get us to do something. But in cases where we see a shirt on the subway and we end up buying something similar, or we see someone more times, we end up liking that person more, there's no pressure there. It's the mere presence of others can affect what we do.
But didn't Muzaffar Sharif doubt the significance of the line experiment? What did he set out to prove?
Yeah, so there were two old scientists that were going back and forth about the power of influence. And actually, the line study was done in response to an earlier study, which was Muzaffar Sharif's study, where he looked at a point of light in a room. So imagine you're in a dark room. It's very hard to see, and there's a point of light on the wall. And someone asks you, how much did the point of light move? Actually, it doesn't move at all. It stays completely still. But because you're in a dark room, it looks like it moves. And they look at what happens when you're in the room with someone else. If someone else says it moves 2 inches, you tend to say it moves 2 inches. If someone else says four, you say it moves four. And this study showed that people are influenced by others, but the line study was a response to that. What the scientist did the line study thought is he said, well, look, of course, when you're in a dark room, you can't tell the answer. Going along with others is useful. If you don't know the right answer, it makes sense. But when you know the right answer, why would you go along? When your own senses tell you what's right, shouldn't you do that thing your own senses are telling you? Even in those situations, we can be influenced by others.
Aren't there situations in which peer pressure can be a good thing?
Certainly. And some people often think influence is a dirty word. It's not four letters, but it seems like a dirty word. People say, oh, influence, doing the same as others, you know, it's a bad thing. Imagine you had to pick a restaurant without asking anyone else about it. Imagine you had to go to a movie without reading online reviews. You had to go on a vacation without talking to anybody. Life would be very difficult. Finding a mechanic without having any information from others would be extremely difficult. And so often we use others as a signal of what we should do. It often helps us to follow others and their information.
On the other hand, some people might respond positively to a Yelp review and not go to that restaurant because that person had a terrible experience. Others just dismiss Yelp reviews. In fact, might very well have an opposite response.
Yeah, and what I love about influence, and I think this is the second big thing that's important from the car story I told earlier, we think that we're influenced only in a certain way. There's a certain flavor. We do the same as others. But actually, there are many flavors of influence. As you just mentioned, sometimes someone does something and we do the complete opposite. That's not us being independent. That's being influenced, but in a different direction. And so in some sense, influence is almost like a magnet. Sometimes it attracts us and leads us to do the same thing as others, but sometimes it repels and leads us to do something different.
Some of these studies are really interesting. What did scientists discover when they observed ferret monkeys and their food selection?
So this is another great study. And what I love about social influence is not just humans, it's animals as well. So there's a story in the book about cockroaches, a story about monkeys. In particular here, we all know that phrase, monkey see, monkey do. But scientists actually wanted to test how that actually played out. So they had monkeys have either red corn or green corn. They took regular corn, they colored it red or green, and they made one of the type of corn taste very bad. They added a bitter liquid that made it bad. And not surprisingly, those monkeys stayed away from whichever corn they thought was bad. But then they had new monkeys that were born to children of those older monkeys, and they saw what happened when they took the bad taste away. So now both the red corn and the green corn actually tasted quite good, delicious for the young monkeys. But the older monkeys knew one of them was old, tasted bad, so they stayed away from that one. And what they found is the younger monkeys stayed away from the same corn that the older ones did, even though they could have eaten both of them. And actually, in some cases, they sat on one pile of corn to eat the other because they thought if the older ones aren't doing it, they shouldn't as well.
You say that male ferret monkeys leave the community at a certain age. Do they still avoid the corn that their tribe was avoiding?
So this is quite interesting, and this tells us a little bit about social norms. You can think about norms with language, for example, where what you might call soda, for example, someone else in the United States might call pop or might call it Coke. That's where we grow up. We have those norms from where we grow up. What happens when we move? Do we adopt the new norms or do we stick with the old ones? And they found that when monkeys moved, it actually changed some of their behavior, right? They moved to a new area and they said, well, look at all these other people. Now they're trying this corn. Maybe it's okay. And so norms shift and so does our own behavior.
This is not in your book, but there was a recent study done with parrots in which it was discovered that parrots have some kind of dialect. And when a group of parrots which speak one dialect move to another group of parrots, they don't understand the dialect. The older parrots tend to stay together. The younger parrots become bilingual.
That, I guess,
that's very much like humans.
Yeah, good news for the U.S. education system, I guess.
My guest is Jonah Berger, whose latest book is Invisible Influences: The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Now, mirror neurons come into this discussion, although there are some scientists who don't believe that there are such things. How do they work?
Yeah, so imagine we're sitting here looking at one another. The mere fact that you engage in a certain behavior makes me more likely to engage in that behavior as well. So if you're sitting there and you cough, I might be more likely to cough. Yawning does as well. Facial expressions, nonverbal behavior. The mere fact that one person is doing something actually make others more likely to do it as well.
And should we assume that that's what happened with the ferret monkeys?
So there's more complicated things than just mimicry, but mimicry has a powerful effect on our behavior as well.
Don't infants learn behavior by observing and mimicking their parents?
Certainly, and that's a powerful way that social influence shapes who we are. Imagine you had to learn everything as an infant from yourself. You couldn't pay attention to your parents, just like if you couldn't use others to figure out where to go or what to buy, it'd be very difficult. And so these mirror neurons are thought, at least by some scientists, to help children learn more complex behaviors that their parents engage in.
And some scientists have linked autism to mirror neuron dysfunction.
Interesting. Yeah, mirror neurons are an exciting area of research, and we definitely don't know everything about them already.
Along these lines, we also come up with differentiation, which is the opposite of mimicry.
It is, and I think this is what's so important. Again, when we think influence, we think doing the same. But there are many cases where we do the exact opposite or do something different. If a group of people is out to dinner and one person orders an entree that you were thinking of getting, you're less likely to order it, even though it makes you less satisfied as a result. If your neighbors start driving a certain car, that make you less likely to buy the car because you don't want to look like the neighbors. And so influence doesn't just act one way. It can shape our behavior in a number of different directions.
How much of this is cultural? Isn't it different with America? Americans than it might be with Japanese?
Americans love to think it's all about being different. We have this myth of sort of the nonconformist in the United States. There's a person out there that's completely unique and different from everybody else. They're uninfluenced by the crowd. We love to see ourselves as, you know, special, unique snowflakes that are different. But it's not that difference is a good thing and being similar is bad. And in other cultural contexts, it's actually much more about fitting in with the group. Why wouldn't you want to do the same thing as others if those others are your family and your friends? Why wouldn't you want to honor your parents and your peers? And so it's not that fitting in or standing out is right or wrong. It's very shaped by the cultural context in which we're brought up.
And does it really matter? Both Japan and the United States have had great successes in many areas. Is one approach preferable to the other?
I don't think so. It's not right or wrong. It depends on the situation and how it plays out. And it's more interesting to understand how it works and to think about how we can use these influences to make our own lives better.
I mentioned voting when I introduced you. Does all of this apply to our political views? Most people inherit their political leanings from their parents, although some change. But we often just tend to associate with people who share our political views.
We certainly do, but what views stand for are also quite important. I recently did a project with a group that wanted to get conservatives to adopt clean energy, so solar power, wind energy. And those things actually should be things that conservatives love. Conservatives like saving money. They want to reduce our impact of foreign oil for national security, so conservatives should love clean energy, yet they don't. When you ask them why, one politician said it very nicely. He said, you know, Al Gore supports clean energy. And if this is something Al Gore is for, it's probably something I'm against. And right there, the point is it's not just about what an issue is. It's what does an issue mean? What does it signal to support clean energy versus not support clean energy? What does it signal to vote for Trump versus Hillary or be a Bernie Sanders supporter? And so voting isn't just about a right answer or wrong answer. It's about what does it communicate to others that we hold a particular belief.
But do we I've seen couples where they have very different political views. I've always wondered how they function with each other. Most of us would prefer to be with somebody who we agree with. And isn't that one of the reasons we choose those people?
Somewhat. But we wouldn't want a spouse that's exactly the similar, a partner exactly the similar as
us,
right?
Oh, I would.
But we at least like some dimensions of difference, right? Adding a little bit of uniqueness to the relationship. And indeed, you're right. We are attracted to people that are similar to us on some dimensions, but we also like some difference as well.
You're right that we imitate other people's behavior while at the same time we try to differentiate ourselves. So that's what the guy with the blue BMW was doing. But are we unaware that we're engaged in this kind of it's almost hypocritical behavior?
I wouldn't say it's hypocritical. Again, it's not a bad thing or a good thing. But what is interesting to me about it, and one reason I wrote this book, is we don't understand these influences. We often don't see them in the world around us. We're often unaware of how it affects our behavior to the positive side or the negative side. And so hopefully by better understanding these often subtle and non-conscious influences, we can take advantage of them, we can choose our influence, and we can live happier and healthier lives.
Jonah Berger is a professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is Invisible Influences, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with a rebroadcast of a conversation I had with Wharton Professor Jonah Berger back in June about his new book called Invisible Influences, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior, which explores how, whether we realize it or not, a lot of what we do and the choices we make are influenced by the people around us. I asked Professor Berger about whether our personal senses of identity might also be influenced by other people.
We have two goals, one to fit in and one to stand out, and there are probably a few others as well. But personal identity is really that standing out a little bit from the group. Even among our friends, we don't want to be exactly the same as everybody else. And so in a sense, we want to be optimally distinct, similar and different at the same time. Similar enough, if we're the only person doing something, that might be a little weird. We like being part of something, yet different enough, at least in American culture, that we feel like we're special. We're not same as everybody else.
But sometimes different is still part of being the same. For example, if you go to Williamsburg or Greenpoint, you see a lot of people who are dressed exactly the same with the same, the men with the same beards wearing short pants, no socks and boots.
Yeah.
I'm sure that they see themselves as dressing distinctively, even though they dress very much like a lot of other people. On the other hand, the people who are judging them are all wearing the same kind of clothes yep. that everybody else wears.
Yeah, and this is going back to the idea of the myth of the nonconformist. We all want to see ourselves as different. There's a great quote. Somebody said, you can't be a nonconformist if you don't drink coffee. And what I love about that is, again, sure, you're different from some people, but you're also the same as a lot of other people. And so we're really similar to our groups, the folks that are like us, but we see ourselves as different by focusing on other groups that we're different from.
But we also send out all sorts of signals by everything from the way our hair is cut to the kind of clothing that we're wearing.
We do. And in some sense, they're markers of not necessarily a tribe that we're part of, but our social group, a set of people that like similar music or have similar tastes. And we signal those things, everything from the products we buy to our political views to the behaviors that we engage in.
People in certain parts of the country like to believe that they smile more than New Yorkers, for example. Is that culturally determined?
I haven't heard that
before.
I can't
believe that they're happier in the Midwest than we are.
But they may focus on different things. I don't know if they smile more, but again, those influences come from who they're surrounded by. It may be that people smile more, move to certain places, but if you're surrounded by a bunch of people that smile, you start to smile more yourself. There's some great research that shows that spouses tend to look alike over time. So sure, we may marry people that look a little bit like us, some same background or similar age, but actually spouses become over time to look more and more similar. And the reason is that we mimic each other's facial expressions. Our spouse smiles, we smile. If they're angry, we get angry. And those repeated expressions leave crinkles or wrinkles on our faces that end up leaving us looking a little bit similar.
How is social status related to our identity and our decision-making?
So there's some very nice research that shows not only is the desire to be different culturally specific, as we talked about, Asian culture, for example, versus American culture, but also even within American culture in terms of socioeconomic status. So more traditionally working-class folks, there's a great experiment was done. They asked MBAs, how would you feel if your friend went out and bought the same car as you? You have a new car, your friend bought the same car. And MBA said, oh, God, I'd be so upset. I'd be angry. I'd be annoyed. And then they asked another group of people how they'd feel, and those people were firefighters. They said, hey, firefighter, how would you feel if one of your friends bought the same car? And they said, I wouldn't feel annoyed. I'd actually be pretty happy. We'd start a car club. And again, it's not about right or wrong. For more working class individuals, they're actually more comfortable being more similar to others. They're brought up the way that the norms and cultural groups are is more similar is an okay thing. And so that's something that expresses itself later in life as well.
I've noticed that when I've been invited to fancy parties, that people are dressed in three different ways. The people who can't afford to dress the way they do at the office, wealthier people will dress up. And then there is a little group of very, very wealthy people who wear wrinkled shirts and blue jeans. And they usually are the richest people in the room.
Yeah. And so it's this idea of counter signaling. Right, so we're communicating something by the way we're dressing, and I love that those three types that you suggested. But if the super wealthy folks dressed exactly like the wealthy folks, you couldn't tell them apart. They'd all be wearing nice clothes, and so often we send subtle signals to differentiate ourselves from other groups. We counter-signal in that case, almost looking like maybe the folks that just came straight from the office with a wrinkled shirt to signal that we're not one of those type of individuals. See the same thing with startups, for example. Startup founders often try very hard to dress down.
Steve Jobs.
No, Steve Jobs. But look at any startup founder today. They're probably wearing a sweatshirt and a T-shirt, and that's their badge of identity. They want to show that they're not a typical stockbroker or finance guy. They want to show that they're different, and they do that through signaling through their clothing.
In one experiment, you asked a student to identify the price of certain name brand bags. Was he able to correctly identify the price of most of them?
Poor guy. So we had him look at different handbags, and some had logos on them and some didn't. And the one that had logos, he was able to correctly identify, but the ones that didn't have logos, he couldn't. And that by itself isn't surprising. People who don't know a lot about fashion might have a hard time telling a high-end bag from a lower-end one.
Is that why Gucci and Louis Vuitton have such large logos on their bags?
Well, so the mid-price stuff does. So if you look, for example, you plot on the x-axis price and the y-axis how big the signals are, how large the logos are, you find that sure enough, more expensive things have larger logos up until a point. Just like your party with the three groups, the really expensive stuff has smaller logos.
Yeah, they tend discretion.
To use, yeah, subtler signals. Almost, I love the phrase, dog whistle fashion, right? Only detectable to those in the know, right? It's a certain color. It's a certain fit. It's a certain way to signal to others that understand that domain what you're signaling, even if not everyone else can tell the difference.
How does counterfeiting help the original company that's being counterfeited?
You would think counterfeiting is a horrible thing for brands. In fact, brands invest a lot of money in security measures and other things to get rid of counterfeiters. Yet there's some data, or at least some argument, to suggest that counterfeits can help. And the reason, very simply, is imagine you're a wealthy individual. You buy very high-end fashion clothes. You buy this year's handbag. You're buying this year's handbag to signal something about yourself. But if a lot of other people have this year's handbag, you may have to move on something else. And that's what counterfeiting does. It makes that item more accessible to a much larger group of people. And in fact, a group of people that you might not want to be associated with if you're extremely wealthy, the folks that are buying counterfeits. And so it actually forces the folks to buy next year's version, right? They can't just stick with this year's version because that no longer signals what they want. They have to move on to something else.
Then there are those people who feel that something with a prominent logo is kind of vulgar, and that says something negative about you.
That's true, but it's not just that. So in our own research, for example, when we looked at logos and price, for example, sure, wealthier folks may not just like logos, but that itself doesn't explain what's going on. Part of it is about who they're trying to communicate and how what they're doing allows them or makes it more difficult to do that communication.
And we often describe people along those lines. And we'll say, oh, he's very Brooks Brothers.
Yes. Or the Brooklyn stereotype that you mentioned before, right? Even certain neighborhoods, a person from Park Slope has a certain identity associated with it.
I'm speaking with Jonah Berger, whose latest book is called Invisible Influences, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And your cover is really interesting because it's kind of hard to read.
So
it doesn't say Gucci on it either.
No, it doesn't. We wanted to build a cover that encapsulated the book. So just like the idea that influence is often hard to see, we built a cover that you can only see part of it depending on the angle you look at it from. You can only see the social influence if you look at it the right way. Unfortunately, it's hard to show online, so I encourage your listeners to check it out in the bookstore. But almost like when you were a kid, if you put a ruler a certain way, you can see something or not. Depending on the way that you look at the cover, it either shows the influence or the influence is hidden.
You say that negotiations are more likely to go well if people do this one thing. What is it?
We talked a little bit about this before, that idea of mimicking others. So, if we're in a tense negotiation and, you're offering a house and I want to buy it and there's a big gap in how much you want to sell it for and how much I want to pay, if I subtly mimic your behavior, your nonverbals, your verbals, your mannerisms, we're five times more likely to reach a deal.
Really? I would think that it would make you more uncomfortable if you felt like you were being imitated.
Yes. And so I'm not saying very obviously. I'm not saying, overweight it and do too much of it, but subtly mimicking others.
You're saying I'm like you?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, imagine someone told you you're from, a small town, and someone told you, oh, I went to the same high school you did. You guys would feel like you're part of the same group. You're part of the same tribe. And so mimicry can help persuasion in a number of contexts. For waiters and waitresses, mimicking the order of the patron that you're taking it from, saying word to word what they're ordering, makes 70% higher tips.
Can you harness that to change someone's mind about something?
Certainly, yeah. And so a lot of the book is not only how we understand these tools, these influences, but how we use them. Whether we're in a negotiation, whether we're trying to persuade the boss or a coworker, we can use mimicry, at least subtly so, to help be more persuasive.
So what's happened in Congress?
I think we need
People dressing differently?
We need another couple hours to talk about that. But I think what is interesting, going back to that example we talked about before, is part of it is the conservatives and the liberals are saying, hey, we don't want to look like the other one, right? I'm not going to adopt anything associated with this side because they're worried it'll hurt them among their own constituents. But that makes it harder to reach an agreement at the end of the day.
So, but in the end, they all wind up wearing the same kind of suits.
They wear the same suits, but they don't support the same issues. That's for sure.
What did you observe when you were studying the eating clubs at Princeton University?
So we wanted to understand how similarity and difference play out in the world. So we actually took pictures of students at Princeton from different eating clubs. Couldn't see their faces. You could just see how they were dressed. And we asked other people if they could guess which eating clubs they were from. And sure enough, most of the time, people were able to correctly identify which club they were from based just on how they were dressed.
Really?
But we also asked them how unique they thought those people were. And sure enough, people who wanted to be more unique, who cared more about standing out from others dressed more uniquely. And so, again, it's a similar indifference at the same time. We buy the same car in a different color. We buy the same clothes in a different fit. We want to fit in with these groups but differentiate to solve both motives at the same time.
But does everybody at Princeton belong to an eating club? Can you tell the people who are not members of an eating club?
We picked two clubs specifically that kind of had identities associated with them. And again, I don't mean to suggest we can know everything about someone based on how they're dressed, but we do this all the time. You know, we see someone on the subway, we see someone at the office, we make judgments about them based on what they're wearing and what they say. And those aren't always correct, but they're often quick heuristics or shortcuts to help make our lives easier.
Can you talk about the Goldilocks effect?
Yeah. So companies often think that it's all about being different. You know, Steve Jobs said, think different. And so when I'm pitching a new idea, I need to tell everybody how different I am from everybody else. But different isn't actually what drives success. It's more about optimally distinct or being different and similar at the same time, a little bit like Goldilocks. You know, too hot on the one end, too cold on the other end, but in the middle is just right. And same with pitching a product or idea. You know, often the things that are successful are similar and different. They're just right. When TiVo came out, they pitched themselves as a digital video recorder. That sounded like something we knew, a video recorder, but they added one word, digital, so we'd get some sense of what it was like. Chobani did the same thing when they came out. They were Greek yogurt, but they cloaked it in some similarity by looking similar to what we were used to seeing yogurts as. And so sometimes the best way to introduce something new is to actually make it feel familiar. The more familiar it feels, the more willing people be to adopt it.
You mentioned earlier experiments with cockroaches. What were you trying to test when you observed cockroach behavior?
So this is an old study from a number of decades ago done by a famous social scientist named Bob Zients. But he was interested in the motivating power of others. And he was wondering whether others motivate us or demotivate us. Are there times when others cause us to work harder or less harder? So he actually built a stadium for cockroaches to run races. So imagine an Olympic stadium where people are running races, but it's filled with cockroaches. So he built a little cube where cockroaches ran races. Sometimes they ran straight races. They ran straight down a path. And other times they had to run straight and then make a turn. And he looked at what happened or how cockroaches' behavior changed when they were audience members. Not people, actually other cockroaches. He built little cockroaches stands with cockroaches standing and watching the other cockroaches. They weren't eating popcorn. They were just sitting there milling around doing what cockroaches do. And what he found is when running straight, having other cockroaches around made cockroaches run faster. But when they had to run a complicated maze, they had to run straight and make a right or a left, having others around made them run slower. And so it turns out this has been shown in decades of research. Others don't just help. Sometimes they can hurt depending on the task we're doing.
Does this just apply to cockroaches?
It doesn't. Same thing has been shown with people. So for simple behaviors or things that we're very good at, let's say like running, having others watch us can make us better. But for more complicated things like parallel parking or tying a bow tie, things we're not good at unless we tie bow ties all the time, having others around can actually make us perform worse.
What about running with somebody else?
Yeah, so this is something I suggest to people all the time. Never exercise alone. So exercise for most of us is something we're pretty good at already. Just like the cockroaches, either doing it with someone else or having someone else around will help us work harder and longer than we would otherwise, whether it's running with someone else rather than by yourself or going to the gym rather than working out at home.
Is all of this perfectly fine? Are there ways that we might want to break the cycle of being influenced by our surroundings and the people around us?
It's not so much breaking the cycle. It's about understanding influence. You know, if we don't understand how it works, we can't change how it's affecting us. I'm not saying influence is a good or a bad thing. Just like any tool, we have to know the right way to use it. And so the first step is identifying it and understanding how it works. And only then can we choose our influence. Only then can we use it to help us make better decisions and avoid worse ones.
Well, often I'll make a decision based on what I think is wrong in someone else. If somebody has a certain kind of a hairstyle,
yep.
That makes me go, ugh. There's no way I'm ever going to do something like that.
Yeah, but even that is influence, right? It's using others to help us be better off, even if we do something completely different. And so I think, you know, that's one thing I hope people realize is influence is not just the same. Sometimes influence is the opposite. You know, it can attract like a magnet or it can repel like a magnet.
Yeah, I have a certain film critic who I feel if he likes a film, then I'm going to dislike it.
Yep.
If he dislikes a film, I'm going to like it. And if we both agree on a film, then I have to go back and reevaluate my position.
But think about how much easier that makes your life, right? Rather than you having to see the film to figure out whether you like it, you can just use them as a diagnostic tool.
So where do you go from here? Are you finished with all of this research?
No. You know, at any point in time, we're working on many new papers in the area. It's an exciting area of work. You mentioned mirror neurons, lots of work going on in that space, understanding the neuroscience of decision making, but also understanding how this shapes trends and what catches on and dies out, what becomes popular and unpopular. Social influence doesn't just affect one person's behavior. It can have a cascading effect. People talk about bandwagon effects and, you know, affect everything from the stock market to how people vote.
So the trend thing, let's talk about, let's say, something going viral on the internet.
Yeah.
It's because somebody else has said this is exciting that I have to check it out?
Well, a little bit. So first, there's a motivation to follow there, right? If you just think about it, you know, someone sends you a YouTube video, one of the first things we do is we'll look at how many other people have watched that YouTube video. If it seems like it's somewhat popular, then we assume it's pretty good and we want to watch it ourselves. But if no one else has watched it, we maybe assume that it's not so good. Yet at the same time, if it's something about identity, something that signals something about us, if too many people are wearing a certain fashion style or saying a certain phrase, we may move on to a new thing because we want to differentiate ourselves. If an indie band becomes popular, people often say, oh, yeah, I used to like their older stuff. Mm-hmm. Right? What's the chance that for all these music artists, people, their older stuff was actually better? But individuals are saying, well, I can't like their new stuff because I'd be the same as everybody else now that they're popular. I have to dislike it as a way of showing my taste.
Invisible Influences, the Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. Is published by Simon & Schuster. Jonah Berger, a professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, wrote it, and it is my great pleasure to have him as a guest today on our show.
Thanks so much for having me again. Really appreciate it.